Hi, and welcome to Mouse Chat. I'm Lisa, and joining me today, I have our Mouse Chatters, Steve, Chris, Sharpie, and Lauren. And we also have a special guest. We have Jim Hill from Jim Hill Media. Welcome, everyone.
Hey, Lisa.
Hey.
We're very excited to have Jim Hill. It's been a while. And he's always busy. He gets to go to all the cool media events, all the cool amusement park things.
He's Jim Hill.
I was out mowing the lawn today, okay? How cool was that?
You were probably
they let you mow the lawn at the Magic Kingdom?
That's exactly.
It's just up here in the woods of New Hampshire, me and the bears and the snapping turtles. So, you know, just it's not all fun stuff. Though, that said, tomorrow, Nancy and I are driving down to New York. This weird thing that Disney does every June. They call it their holiday showcase, where basically they show off everything that's going to be on sale for Christmas. So, well, not everything. Last year, they were really cagey about the Frozen stuff, you know, just sort of like, you know, they weren't ready to show that off in June. And, of course, it was all sold by July. So,
pretty much.
But that's another story. So,
that sounds fun, though.
It is, but it's weird because it's just one of these things where you have, you know, typically what Disney will do is take an entire floor of a hotel and empty all the rooms of furniture. So you go from room to room to room to room. And I honestly felt bad the year of Tron Legacy because you're in there with the Tron guys. And it's like, this is going to be a hit. Look at these toys. Oh, my God. You know, and it's just, you know somewhere there's a landfill right now filled with, you know, thousands of Tron action figures. You know, so
more sub-Saharan African children know of Tron than American children.
There you go. And just think of the poor archaeologist, you know, a couple of thousand years from now. I don't know why they worship them, but they have talking faces. So,
it never made its way to the United States, though. Popular in Africa.
You know, and the weird thing is every so often you do hear them talking about Tron 3, though I guess the final nail in the coffin was how poorly the animated series did. That was supposed to sort of convince the people at the studio that, hey, people are still interested in this. And it's like, I think they eventually began airing it at 4 a.m., which, you know, says a lot about, you know, how confident they were in the show. So,
good. So was this invitation only, or can anyone get into this?
Very much invitation only. It's kind of interesting to watch them, you know, because again, the elevator will open and people look out, you know, the stop on the floor and it's like, Mickey Mouse, what's going on here? Get back in the elevator. You know,
I was going to send Lauren.
You know, you saw nothing. Go away. You know, but again, you just go from room to room to room and it's, you know, here's the, you know, the mini fashion room and here's the, you know, whatever film is coming out on DVD this year. All of the products that'll be supporting that.
Nice.
I would imagine there's going to be an awful lot of stuff about Cinderella and maybe Big Hero 6. But anyway, that's tomorrow. We're supposed to be talking about other stuff, right?
Yes. Let's go ahead and go straight from Mickey Mouse over to Universal. Did a recent visit to Universal Studios where you got to check out the new Diagon Alley.
Yep.
How was that? Tell us all about it.
It's kind of hard to sum up because it's really ambitious. I mean, again, you come through the wall at the Leaky Cauldron and, you know, it's kind of like if you did Cars Land in California, but you started at the back with the rock work where it's going up seven stories. I mean, you can't see anything. When you're in Diagon Alley, the buildings go up four and five stories tall. So you are, you know, I know Universal keeps using this word immersed, but in this case, it's true. You know, you can't see any other part of the theme park. And I'm sure you've seen the concept art for, you know, the main drag of Diagon Alley and how it ends at Gringotts and with the dragon on top.
Yeah.
But the crossroads, whether it's to horizontally, I can never say that name, which leads to Carket Market and likewise Nocturne Alley. These are actually really sizable spaces. They've actually, you know, they were When you talk with the folks at Universal Creative and the folks at Warner Brothers who they brought back, Stuart Craig and Ian Gilmore, these are the art directors from the Harry Potter films. And they really applied the lessons that they'd learned from Hogsmeade, that they'd learned the hard way by sticking too closely to the way the film looked and keeping the buildings close together, that it made that space. I mean, I'm sure some of you have been there by now and, you know that it's kind of tight in there, and coupled with the fact that the buildings are basically built out of black stone covered with, you know, faux snow, that come the summer, you know, that place really holds the heat, which I always thought had something to do with the huge sales for Butterbeer. You know, you came in and it's like, I'm dying of thirst. Well, here, have a $7 Butterbeer. It's like, but it's this one, because it's in the movie park, they took a lot more. It was less based on the fiction and more based on the film. So, you know, you can go into Weasley Wizard Wheezes. And in fact, that's a great place to talk about how insane they get about the level of detail. And in fact, I got to talk with Tom Williams, who's the chairman of Universal Parks and Resorts, and he told me this great story about an invoice comes across his desk, and it's like, well, what the hell is this? It's, well, something in, you know, Weasley Wizard Wheezes, and, well, I want to see what I paid for. So he goes down to the construction site, and it's like, where is this fireworks thing? And it's like, oh. And so they basically back Tom into a corner and point up to the ceiling three stories up. And there, through the interweaving staircases for the shop, yeah, he can see a skylight where there's a fireworks display that's going on perpetually. And that's supposedly something that George and his brother have conjured up. But again, there's only two places in the shop you can see this.
Wow.
You know, I mean, and one of them is if you're at the checkout stand, but even then you have to sort of press yourself into the checkout stand and look up over the cash register. But again, you know, that 90% of the guests who go into that shop are never going to see this stuff.
Wow.
But it's there.
Hmm. Well, and they did a lot of that at Disney World, where they kind of add those extra touches that, you know, the general public really doesn't see. And then it makes it nice for the fans when they come back and they're really into it and they have something else to kind of see and explore.
Well, the interesting thing is that of all the people on the planet who are interested in getting into Diagon Alley and checking it out, there's no more people who are interested in this than Walt Disney Imagineers. In fact, the folks at Universal Creative were telling, you know, kind of giggling into their hands about, they had evidently, because again, it's a very small community, the people who work in themed entertainment, and
yeah,
somebody put out the word that, well, you know, Diagon Alley is going to have a soft opening tomorrow. And so, you know, so here's the folks from Universal Creative looking over the temporary fence, and here are three of the key players from from Walt Disney Imagineering Florida, just sort of hanging back, waiting to get in. And it's like, sorry, guys, not actually opening today. Ha ha. You know, so you know, these poor guys had made a trip to the park just to check out what the competition was up to. I don't know. I know that for a lot of people who listen to this podcast, you know, Disney is kind of their favorite sports team and they're always rooting for them to win. And so they're the ones who will downplay or dismiss a Universal, you know, when they do something like this, when they do something that really sort of ups their game. And I think that's the wrong mindset to have, because let's be honest here, as theme park enthusiasts, we all win when something like this happens. You know, I mean, think about it. You know, when Hogsmeade Village was being, you know, completed, Disney was working on Cars Land. And when they saw how good it was, they slipped some more money into the budget. And we all got this amazing recreation of that world. And, you know, now we've got Diagon Alley. And, you know, you have to understand that the folks who were working on Star Wars Land for both Disneyland and Disney's Hollywood Studios, it's the same thing. They're kind of staring down the barrel of like, whoa, we have to reclaim the high ground. So let's do something that has a lot of effects, that has a lot of detail. And in fact, my understanding is that I'm sure you've heard about the interactive wands that they have for Diagon Alley. There's actually 18 different places within the land where you can kind of sort of wave your wand and some sort of physical effect happens. And to be, you know, that to be clear, there's also 9 places that they've installed over at Hogsmeade Village. So it's, you know, you get to use your wand wherever you are in the Wizarding World. But Disney, evidently, to sort of combat this, is creating what they're going to be calling force moments within Star Wars Land. And supposedly the idea is that you know, you'll come around a corner, there'll be a marker on the ground, and if, you know, you sort of do a using the force type gesture, you know, doors will open or giant heavy crates will lift or that sort of thing. And and I think some of that will actually kick off of the magic bands that, you know, you know, you will get the opportunity to, are you on the dark side or, you know, or are you a Jedi, you know, and that will determine which effects you can actually do.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
I like that. But again, I like little hidden secrets like that.
But yeah, we're still, just to be fair here, if all had gone according to plan, they were supposed to start construction of that in January of this year. But I'm sure you've heard the stories about, there were some concerns with the script for episode 7. And in fact, they, so much so that they actually brought in Lawrence Kasdan, who you may know was the scriptwriter with Leah Brackett on Empire Strikes Back. And so, you know, the fact that they reached out to one of the original screenwriters to come sort of futz and fix the script is a good sign. But the downside of that is that Iger was the one who actually said, look, if we're rewriting the script, maybe we want to hold off on, you know, starting construction on Star Wars Land, because what if the script gets rewritten as a new character or in a new setting that suddenly really lends itself to a theme park, you know, to attraction or show or shop or something like that. So, yeah.
So the Imagineers, is that definite that that's going to happen?
Well, that, at Star Wars Land?
Yeah.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. In fact, I don't know what you've heard about the plans for Disney Hollywood Studios, but basically, well, for starters, Echo Lake goes away. When you walk into that park, that very first cross street, you know, where yep. you duck down and you can go to the Hollywood and Dine, you know, buffeteria, or you can continue on
yeah.
to Indiana Jones. That's, you know, the lake there with the dinosaur and the ship, it's gone. What you're going to see now is Tatooine. You know, you're going to come around the corner and you know, there's the bar that Obi-Wan and Luke went into for their initial meeting with Chewie and Han Han. And if you want, you can get your blue milk and you can sit there and listen to the band. And there will be a street that just continues all the way down to Star Tours that will feature all manner of Star Wars stuff. There's going to be a X-Wing spinner where not only can you do the standard sort of Dumbo up and down thing, but there's going to be a switch that will allow you to open and close the X-Wing wings. Let's see.
Oh, that's great for the little ones. They need
that's the idea. Like that. They're trying to create a certain amount of balance. Also, they're trying to address some issues that, frankly, Disney Hollywood Studios has always had with its Star Wars shows. I mean, take, for example, the Jedi Academy show. Very popular. Kids really enjoy it. But, again, this is Florida. It rains. And there are times when, you know, you've got a crowd standing there and, you know, show can be underway and it'll begin to rain. And it's like, I'm sorry, we have to cancel, kids. And, you know, we're Jedi masters, but we can't do this in the rain. Mm-hmm. So what they're planning on doing is taking the Old Sound Dangerous Theater and moving it indoors. And the nice thing about that is it means that mom and dad can sit down and watch the show. It also means that you can do that many more practical effects in the theater itself. You know, and of course, the classic Disney thing, you can exit through a gift shop. And my understanding is that they've been doing some experimenting with an AA version of Yoda, and he would be, you know, featured in the show, whether as a guest star or that sort of thing, would just sort of appear. I guess there's one version of the script where he's actually the host of the show. But where this gets kind of interesting is that the initial plan for Indiana Jones Epic Stunt Show was that this was where they were actually going to pull down the theater and build a speeder bike attraction. You may remember from Jedi the sequence where they're riding through the forest at high speed. They've actually mocked this up in a really cool fashion. It uses the cave technology that Disney likes to use in the design. I mean, basically, you're sitting on a speeder bike. I think you can do, one family member with you if you choose, but mostly it's an individual experience. But there's 50 different rooms that would be set up to do this, and they could do this 3-minute long experience where your bike is moving in sync, and the film is moving in sync to what you're doing. But what ended up happening there is December of last year, Disney came to terms with Paramount and got the rights to Indiana Jones. And so it suddenly Disney is not only in the Star Wars business, it's back in the Indiana Jones business. And this isn't necessarily a bad thing from a Disney Hollywood Studios point of view. They'd actually booked out the Epic Stunt Show Theater through 2017 for corporate events. I mean, they do banquets in there. There are also cheerleader competitions. So they were going to have to make good with a lot of those folks. And so that actually is now off the table. The Epic Stunt Show stays where it is. Disney may be updating it, but now it looks like what they have decided to do is move the.
This
is all going to stay in the front of the park. In fact, that's where it gets genuinely interesting, because there's going to be Star Wars Land to the front, and then toward the back, you're going to see Pixar slowly become a bigger and bigger presence.
Nice.
It's actually not America's Got Talent, the other show, the American Idol.
Yeah.
Disney had a deal with Fremantle Media, the folks who make the TV show. They had signed a deal. They had the rights for 5 years with three options to extend the deal, each a 5-year increment, with the notion that, if the show's television so stayed popular, that attraction could be in Disney Hollywood Studios for 20 years. Unfortunately, not only is the TV series ratings kind of tanking, basically from year two, interest fell through the floor on the American Idol live show.
Yeah.
That, and it became very difficult for Disney to not only recruit people out of the park to appear in it, but it's a really manpower heavy show. I mean, if you ever actually sit in there and start counting heads as to how many people Disney needs to run all these shows, it's a lot of paychecks. So that's shutting down in January. And that seems to be the new timetable for the kickoff for the Star Wars Land, that now that they've got a script that they like, and they're obviously already shooting it. We've all heard about Harrison Ford breaking his ankle. And in fact, what's kind of interesting is, there's been some conversations about, because he may need as much as 6 months rehab, physical rehab before he can come back and shoot. They may use this as an excuse to push the release date of episode 7 from December of next year out to May, which has been the traditional time that all the Star Wars films have come out. The problem is, I think there's already a Marvel movie that sort of stuck its flag for Disney in that month, and there would have to be some very interesting negotiations, because Marvel right now is very much the top dog at Disney. They are, there's a lot of people on the main lot in Burbank who are being pushed out of their offices, because everybody who worked for Marvel who was over at their Manhattan Beach facility is now coming over to Burbank and wants to be in the main lot. So they actually just tore down Disney's carpentry shop to make room for more production facilities, because going forward, all the Marvel films the stuff that's not shot on location or overseas is going to be shot right there on the Disney lot in Burbank. So, but anyway, that's the Star Wars part of the equation, and Disneyland's going to see just as big. That one gets interesting, though, because, you know, when you start to look at Disneyland, the only place that, Star Wars really fits is Tomorrowland. And in order to make room for this, you have to start taking things out.
Yeah.
And right now, the rumor is that the Finding Nemo subs, they're coming back. They're under a rehab right now, and they will be back for Disneyland's 60th anniversary year, which is 2015. But after that, it gets kind of dicey. You guys are aware that like California's in the middle of like this, the most severe drought on record for them, right?
Oh wow!
Yeah, and so it's been ongoing for, 2 years now, right?
Closer to five is my understanding. Wow. And so, what Disneyland is thinking of doing, and it's actually a really clever PR move, is that there's 5 million gallons of water in the Finding Nemo sub lagoon. And more to the point, because, you know, that every time they bring this ride back, there were leaks, you know, that they constantly have to keep refilling the lagoon because it's leaking out into the Orange County aquifer. And, you know, there's people within Disney. It's like, look, we have this giant piece of real estate in the middle of the park that, frankly, again, one of the reasons they shut down the attraction in 98. And it took them almost 10 years to bring it back, was that it's a maintenance nightmare. It's really slow to load. You have to shut it down at least once a year for a 3-month long rehab. We have to go back and repaint all the coral and the fish because, you know, the chemicals to keep it clear bleaches everything out. And it said, well, why don't we just close it and then volunteer to, after we treat the water, return all 5 million gallons to the aquifer. It makes us look like, you know, good citizens. You know, we do this far enough in advance that, you know, we announce it far enough in advance that people who love the subs can come back and say goodbye. And then we just take it out. We have this giant piece of real estate in the middle of the park. And what's interesting about that is the other thing that's right next to that. In fact, the Autopia goes back and forth. If you understand how the park is laid out, the Autopia is basically on top of the roof of the submarine's show building. A lot of the dark scenes, the you know, whether you're, when you're up at the North Pole or you know, seeing the lava and all that, that's, you're driving on top of that when you're in the Autopia. What they're thinking of doing with the Autopia is also shutting that down and moving it over to DCA. The kind of the way the chess pieces move around the board is you rip out Luigi's, which has been kind of a disaster.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just slow to load and
the irony is rich. Yes.
I agree. In fact, that's the funniest part of it is that when Lasseter himself pushed for that attraction to come back, and everyone kind of blinked at him, because those who had been in the building long enough to remember what a maintenance nightmare the Flying Saucers had been, just sort of like, but this time we'll do it different. And it's like from day one, it didn't work. So they ripped that out. And it turns out right behind the wall there is an expansion pad that was originally supposed to be the West Coast version of Sci-Fi Dine-In. But the gimmick is that you would be seeing in cars in the drive-in at that you saw in Radiator Springs.
Yeah. You know,
So, but that'll be taken off the table. And the notion is you move the Autopia over there. You do all the cars electric. You create kind of a miniature, take on the Radiator Springs environment. And, you know, so you still have, for the kids in California who want that driving experience when they're 3 to 5 years old, they'll still have it. It'll just be over at DCA now rather than
it fits into that perfectly.
Yeah. And this is I was just out there for the Cinco de Mayo stuff, and there's a great parking lot, you know, just slab right out there ready to go. They could develop it in a heartbeat.
Nice.
It wouldn't necessarily probably be quite the huge track layout that they have over Disneyland. But, the nice thing is that you, with a 1-2 punch like that, you create this giant space of you know, develop a land right in the middle of the park that you can seed over to Star Wars or Marvel. And, you know, that's part of the other conversation that's going on now, you know, about do we do something, you know, because right now Marvel just keeps increasingly getting shoehorned into the old Carousel of Progress building. And it's like, should we do something, you know, of size, or should we wait and take the old Strawberry Fields, which is now, you know, the cast member parking, you know, the thing that's across from the Anaheim Convention Center. And it's like, should that be park number three? And, you know, just there's some very interesting conversations going on about Disneyland and the Disneyland Resort right now. That and the problem is, to be blunt, in 2016, the Wizarding World of Harry Potter opens at Universal Studios Hollywood. And they're not kidding around out there. They're taking everything that they've learned from Hogsmeade Village at Islands of Adventure and Diagon Alley. They're even applying lessons from that they've learned from the Japanese version of Wizarding World, the Universal Studios Japan in Osaka. Their version of the Wizarding World actually opens on July 15th, just a week after Diagon Alley opens.
Wow.
They're doing a full-size castle in Hollywood. I mean, I was there Thursday before last looking at, you know, as you come down the escalator to go to get on the tram, that this is monstrous construction site, which is going to have, you know, the new bells and whistles version of Forbidden Journey and possibly a dining experience, and I mean the Great Hall. They're not kidding around, and that's, I think, the thing that a lot of Disney fans don't understand about the Southern California themed entertainment market. It's really, really competitive, and out there, when you're drawing guests who, you know, 60-70% of your guests come from 100 miles away. I mean, they're locals. Now, yes, there are the 30% who fly in, who stay at the hotels and do, you know, think of this as a destination resort. But there's also a big component that just think of this as, you know, going to Disneyland for the day, which is another reason why you see Disneyland really go crazy with Halloween and really go crazy with Christmas. You know, that they're trying to get two visits a year out of the Southern California locals. And frankly, the folks at Disneyland are terrified that the summer that 2016, when Harry Potter opens, people are going to make the decision. They're like, okay, we'll go to Disneyland once this year, but we're going to go to Universal and check out that Harry Potter thing. And that really does change the game. And so, you know, the park, the VPs at both DCA and Disneyland have been, you know, come on, come on, come on, come on. Where's my big attraction? Come on, where's my e-ticket? What are we doing for 2016? We got to get moving on this. And Disneyland management hasn't yet flashed on this, or it's I don't know whether it's there's a hesitancy from the board of directors level, because it's like, look, we just put $1.2 billion into DCA, and you're looking for another $500 million for an e-ticket and a new land, and can we get some of that money back first before we spend some more money? And so, yeah, and they're assuming now that for a lot of people,
yeah,
just the 60th anniversary of Disneyland will be enough for them to make a trip to Anaheim. So, I don't know. it's kind of short-sighted.
Yeah, you would hope, but,
you know, and in fact, I guess there had been some discussion that by then, by 2016, they would be bringing, initially the thought was, well, Magic Bands will be coming online that year, and that'll be such a game changer.
Oh, that'll be exciting.
But I don't think that's happening. So,
yeah.
Game changer, point loss.
Yeah, Magic Sorry. Bands, I don't think, is a reason to go. It's kind of like the opposite, it seems like, for a lot of people. I don't know. It depends on who, if you're the family going once in a lifetime or once every 3 or 4 years, or if you're the local person going, combating all the people that have reservations and you don't. And now you can't get a fast pass anymore. So
well, what's the anticipated date, by the way, for Star Wars Land to be completed? Do they have one?
Okay. Well, all right. Here's the thing. You have to understand the Disney World mentality. The notion is that every 3.75 years, and that's supposedly the time that the typical family, you know, those that will go to Disney World for a family vacation, that's their period of time between when they'll go, you know, when they'll think about, boy, we need to go back. So they always like to have a big attraction.
Gosh, I think that every 3 months.
Well, you know,
sorry.
Just let's talk about that in August, shall we? You know, just sort of like, you know, when you feel like you're swimming up Main Street because of the heat and the humidity.
That's about
So sorry, go ahead. You already had in the pipeline Avatar. In fact, that's the funniest thing about talking with the people at Disney these days, and they're just like, if we had just known that George Lucas was looking to retire and was going to put Star Wars on the market, we never would have made this deal with James Cameron. You know, and at the same time, the other thing that sort of drove the bus of the James Cameron Avatar decision was the notion of we're building parks in Shanghai. We are looking, well, they were looking until the Brazilian economy tanked to go there, as that was going to be the next big resort after Shanghai. And the notion was that when you go international, it really helps to be in territories that don't really know the Disney and the Pixar characters well, to have other, you know, other things you can take advantage of. So when you advertise the park, you can say, hey, we got Mickey Mouse and we got Buzz Lightyear and we got Luke Skywalker and we got whoever the hell this blue guy is. But hey, you all bought tickets, so come see him. So that was kind of one of the other reasons that Tom Staggs and Iger really pushed the Pandora deal through. But if they'd known, if they had an inkling that, you know, Star Wars available, they would have never made the deal with Cameron. But now, you know, they have no choice. They're in bed with the guy and they've got to go forward with, you know, the project for Animal Kingdom. And in theory, that stuff, I know the executives at Oriental Land Company have just sort of said, all right, finish it. We'll come over. We'll take a look at it. And if we like it, then we'll consider either adding it to Tokyo Disney Seas or there's a third theme park. There's potentially space for a third theme park over there that they would maybe then drop this into.
It's funny because Avatar Land was something I was never really excited about until mm-hmm. I saw the recent you know, drawings and interpretations of what it's going to be. I think it's going to be phenomenal now, and I really think it's a good addition to Animal Kingdom.
Well, you know,
it's a perfect fit.
Yeah, and it's needed.
Well, I mean, no argument there. I mean, it just look. This is, you know, you guys know, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon at Animal Kingdom, you could fire a cannon, you know, from the main entrance down across that bridge to the Tree of Life and not hit anybody. I mean, everyone's already bailed out of the park.
Right.
You know, so in order for this to be a full day park, they need new lands. They need new attractions. And particularly now with this whole River of Light thing, which I
love that.
But River of Light's been in development for 10 years. You know, this is something that they've wanted to do, but they couldn't turn the switch on because, you know, if nobody's in the park, you know, after 5, how do you have a nighttime show?
Right.
So, and the whole point of, you know, and they keep, you'll notice the artwork that they keep showing you is, you know, by the way, if you stick around at night, whoo-hoo, look at how pretty the land of Pandora is. Woof. You know, all that bioluminescence, you got to be here for that. So that's, you know, the whole notion. And, hey, the River of Light is also here. And so that means you have to eat in our restaurants. And, yeah, having a meal in restaurants and shop while you're waiting. So, that's Avatar. Avatar opens 2017, fully loaded. I guess they're hoping to have some component of it ready 2016, kind of in a new fantasy land sort of way. You open
a little bit of phases.
That's it, exactly. And you know, you're fully open by 2017. If they turn the key on construction for January, and that seems to be the way they're leaning, so that's 2018. you know, so you've got Star Wars Land open over at Disney Hollywood Studios. And then after that, you know, and in between that, of course, you've got what's going on with, what is it, the Norway Pavilion in Frozen. That's really happening, by the way.
So what's the backstory on that? What are they doing there for sure?
Basically, it's, I got to tell you, there's not a lot of enthusiasm at 1401 Flower Street for this. There's some real problems with this idea. First and foremost, if you've been on the Maelstrom, you know it's a slow-loading attraction. And this is the thing. They're keeping the ride track in place. The ride vehicles you experience in this thing are the ride vehicles, you know, and the twists and the turns and all that. That's what you're going to get. And this, at its best, at full capacity, when everybody's behaving themselves, they can only get 900 to 1,000 people per hour through this thing.
Wow.
So, this isn't Haunted Mansion territory where you're talking 2,400 people an hour. This is, you know, you're going to have some long lines. But to accommodate the long lines, movie theater in the post-show goes away. Your cute little Norwegian village, that goes away. In fact, they're swapping the entrances and the exits. So, in fact, there'll be a lot of queue inside of what used to be show sets and that sort of thing. So the line problems you saw this past summer when people were online for Anna and Elsa for 5 hours and the line was actually going out
to
around
the China Pavilion.
Yeah. I mean, the folks in Norway got a lot of crap from folks in China and from the people who were, try to keep traffic moving around World Showcase Lagoon. Because again, you know, people who can't get to their dining reservation over Italy or Germany get cranky, you know, and, you know, that you don't want people saying, well, you don't want to go to Epcot, it's too crowded, you know. So it's just sort of like, that was the whole notion of moving Anna and Elsa over to the Magic Kingdom to sort of, you know, to make these people happy for a couple of months. Because once construction begins in January, and the walls go up, that's disruptive. And then when this thing finally opens up and people come back, that's going to be equally disruptive. But yeah,
so they're going to be moving Anna and Elsa back to Norway eventually.
Magic 8-Ball says yes, but conditionally they're talking about making Anchor House basically an Anna and Elsa dining experience that goes, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner. So, you know, the belief is, I mean, face it, if they start construction on this in January and it's a 15 to 18 month build, they anticipate they'd be open for business in June-ish, you know, maybe a soft opening in March, but, you know, officially full-blown open June-ish of 2016. You know, in a house at Disney, it's like, is Frozen really still going to be a huge thing then? You know, and, you know, so, you know, should we plan that, you know, they're going to be 5-hour lines or honestly, by then, is there some other Disney character or some other character period that people are going to be enthusiastic about? You know, that's because right now, I mean, if you talk with people within Disney, they're anticipating that, you know, Frozen, in fact, I'm looking forward to talking with the consumer products folks tomorrow in New York, because it's like, to hear Iger talk, Anna and Elsa are now a top 5 franchise for Disney, you know, and they're going to get that sort of support. I mean, just for example, this summer, there's a brand new wave of Frozen merchandise coming out this summer. Holiday 2014, brand new wave then, and, you know, that there's the phrase they use now is, you know, maintain. You know, it can this franchise be grown? You know, I remember talking with somebody about this whole wave of Olaf summer merch, where it's Olaf on, you know, on lying on towels, and Olaf, you know, cool drink sets, you know, just with the whole notion of playing off of his In Summer song from that movie. You know, and just literally taking that component, that short scene of the movie, and it's like, how many consumer products can we get out of this one scene out of the movie? And go, you know, and just, you know, everybody just tried to come up with as many ideas as possible and then go to the licensees and the manufacturers and to see how soon they could get the stuff out here. So there'll be some stuff this summer, but next summer, oof, you know, I mean, you won't be able to go to the Disney store without seeing Olaf in Summer and, you know, people desperately trying to make you to buy it. But again, it's when this thing reopens in 2016, is this still going to be the same way? You know, they are still going to have people be this enthusiastic, and, you know, so you have to sort of adjust your parameters, you know, as to, well, how big a line will we need for the meet and greet, and should we be doing like Mickey? And do you remember when Mickey's Birthday Land opened in 88?
Ugh.
And if you
unfortunately, I hated that.
Well, but the weird thing is, there were people who just like lined up for.
It was the only land that I thought they did on the cheap, because it was like, all right, we got to throw something up, and we're going to take a bunch of circus tents, we're going to put them up, and then we're going to leave them here for 20 years or something.
It's interesting you mentioned the circus tents. If you remember the original plans for New Fantasyland,
yep,
and how, you know, circus tents were gone. You know, you had Pixie Hollow, you had a sort of a spinner down there, you had a pixie dust tree and all that. It was actually the retail folks who came back, and it's like, you're going to pull down County Bounty? And I said, well, yeah, you know, it doesn't fit the theme of the area. And it's like, are you high? And it's like, what? And it turns out County Bounty, because, I mean, think about it. If you're... you know, your two parents, and you're bringing your child in to do the meet and greet that, you know, fed off of that area. Invariably, it was, you know, okay, one parent would take the child in, would go stand in the line in 45 minutes. The other parent would be sitting out there or standing in the retail area and just walking around and around and around and around. And eventually, just out of sheer boredom, they'd crack, you know, they'd buy a plush, they'd buy a hat, they'd buy something.
Yep.
All right.
Yeah.
That retail area, because of that setup, was second only in sales to the Emporium.
That's impressive.
So, yeah. That was Lisa and I with waiting in line, and then she would come back with popcorn or cotton candy or something, because we'd be sitting there to see Mickey or somebody. Mm-hmm. Yep. We were there.
That was us. Sucker written across our forehead.
But that's the thing.
And so a sucker in our hand, too.
You know,
you took the words right out of my mouth.
But they just weren't willing to give that up. So that the retail operations folks literally twisted the arms of the Imagineers. And it's like, you're not pulling down that building. Figure out how to keep it there. Figure out how to keep the character meet and greets, the thing in place. You know, because we're not willing to give up that much money. And that's how Dumbo suddenly shifted over there. And that's how, you know, you got that whole circus thing going. In fact, that's actually one of my favorite, you know, fun little stories about where how hard Disney works at keeping John Lasseter happy. John, as you know, is a huge train buff. And evidently when they showed him the retooled design, and, you know, so we're going to put the train station down here, and this is where the circus train comes in. And John's like, oh, that's great. But, you know, the one thing that this is missing, and there's so many train buffs like myself who want that beautiful photograph of when the train pulls into the station and when they refill it from the water station, and just the way this is set up, it's just not conducive to, you know, to getting that killer photograph. And it was just sort of like, well, John wants it. So there's literally, if you know that trail that you can take that actually will take you back to Space Mountain?
Yep, yep.
If you walk down that about 30 feet, you'll suddenly notice that there's this weird little jut into into the trail. And you can actually, if you turn around, you step into the corner and look around, you are now standing. You have the most beautiful shot of the train when it's pulled in and stopped. I mean, it just, you know, every train buff on the planet is sort of like, oh, the beauty shot. And it's like, they spent $300,000 to build this one thing. So when John came, they could lead him down. You know the thing you asked for? Look, it's right there. You know, just, you know, so John would be happy. But yeah, there's a lot of that that goes on these days. It's very nice. Make John happy, because when John's happy, he says yes, and yes is good. You get a project. So
now I was at Disneyland Paris. I was in Paris for a month, and I came back right before I went over to see at Walt Disney Studios to see Ratatouille, and of course it wasn't open, and it wasn't open, and it wasn't open, and then they were going to have a press event. I think June 27th and 28th, which it sounds like they bumped up. So my last day there, I went, and of course it wasn't there, and I took pictures over the wall. So I heard you actually talk to them about the Remy new Dark Ride and the new restaurant.
I got to talk to Roger Gould, who is the Pixar's liaison to Walt Disney Imagineering, and I also got to talk with Liz Gazzano, who is the executive producer of this project. And this is kind of an interesting bend on the Mystic Manor idea.
That's very cool.
We're back to the Winnie the Pooh's Honey Hunt trackless vehicles.
Yep.
But this is also a 3D movie that you ride through. Pixar spent months working on the footage. In fact, what's really cool about this is Brad Bird, the director of Ratatouille, actually came back and, you know, directed scenes for this, gave notes on the storyboards. I mean, he was, you know, this is a guy who's really, really busy with live action stuff. In fact, he's busy shooting Tomorrowland for Disneyland, the George Clooney film. And but still came back to Pixar, and he was, you know, he wanted, if they were going to do an attraction, by God, it was going to look like the movie. But it's this amazing mix of and in fact, it was Liz who was telling me about this, that they have figured out how, this is the first time ever that somebody's done an attraction that, then again, this is in 3D. So you're, you know, I don't know how they're explaining, you know, why you have to wear 3D goggles. It was, you know, kind of funny when you rode Gringotts coaster that, you know, you're going down into the mine. So wear your mine goggles. So I don't know what, you know, this is, I guess, the stuff you have to wear so the sauce and the grease doesn't get in your face while you're cooking. But no, they've actually figured out how, if you're riding in this mouse-shaped vehicle going through the attraction, this 3D surrounding you basically 180 degrees, and they've figured out the algorithms, evidently this ridiculously complex mathematical process whereby the 3D works fully in 180 degrees. So, you know, for example, if you're looking footage of Remy, you know, directly in front of you, and to your left, you've got Emil and then a giant Chef Skinner bearing down on you from the right. It's all crystal clear 3D, you know, and it just, none of it blurs, none of it, you know, so you buy the idea. In fact, that Liz had this amazing stat about, they were working on the ride film for this thing, and you know, with this complex geometry that was involved with doing the film elements, you know, one of their engineers went like, Jesus, I don't know. I'm thinking that the work file for this, when we finally finish working on it, will actually be four times the size of the original Ratatouille, the files they used to actually make the movie.
Wow.
And so they were at the wrap party, and the guy came up and said, oh, no, I was wrong. I apologize. It wasn't four times. It was eight times, you know, but, wow. But it works. I mean, it's just, everybody who's been on the thing just raves about this. I mean, they do giant dimensional props. They do, you know, for example, you go into the pantry and, you know, you have giant, you know, piles of vegetables, and, you know, this is going up, you know, I mean, it's a giant, giant, giant show building, you know, four and five stories tall in some of the scenes. And the best part of it is that once you finish, and again, what I have to admire the fact that after all these years of making people exit through a gift shop, for Ratatouille, they did something kind of brave. This time around, you exit into a restaurant. You know, I mean, you this ride that celebrates, you know, that food and in a way that, that, you know, I mean, face it, when you saw Ratatouille, you left the theater and going, I would really enjoy a French meal right about now. and Bistro Chez Remy is right there. And the best part of it is this isn't the human restaurant from the movie. This is the rat restaurant. So you're going into a building where, for example, you know how you can twist the wire on a cork for a bottle of champagne and make a chair out of it? Those are the chairs you're sitting on. You're sitting on corks. The wire has been twisted into the shape. You've got giant knives and forks sort of forming the walls of the room. And at the same time, you've got this great, wonderful menu that they put together. And that coupled with the fact that they went back and they tried to recreate. I mean, I'm sure looking over the fence, you saw, you know, how hard they worked to sort of.
It's weird because, I would come in from Paris and then I would go there. Then I'd run over there and I'd take pictures of a nice, clean Paris. Yep. It's like, this is where I just came from.
Yeah. But the weird thing of it is if once you get past the fence, you'll find out that it's really a Valentine to France. In fact, that was the thing. Roger Gould actually brought this up. They were really worried when they were making Ratatouille. They thought, what are the French going to say about this? Because face it, that in a lot of ways that movie makes fun of the French, and you know Skinner is, you know, kind of a walking cliche. Likewise, you know, Auguste Gusteau. But it turns out the French loved the movie. They thought it was this sweet Valentine to, you know, their values and, you know, that and how beautiful they made Paris look. So, you know, they felt that, well, if we're building this land and it's interesting, Tom Fitzgerald, the gentleman who used to, be sort of the lead guy at Imagineering, who just recently has been put in charge of the redo of Epcot. He's the guy who wrote The Herd on this, and just the whole notion of, well, look, we can't, you know, we're doing Paris outside of Paris.
Yeah.
So we have to be smart about this. And what they've done is that it's this romantic caricature of Paris that if you're really paying attention, you begin to realize that there are rats everywhere. You know, that there's the Remy, forget about Hidden Mickeys. This is the land of the Hidden Remy. And so he's in the benches. He's in the fountains. He's in, you know, the architecture of the buildings. He's everywhere. And particularly at night, they put together a lighting package for this thing that, again, Paris is the city of light.
Yeah.
And evidently this is just, it's stunning. I guess what's kind of interesting is that for everybody who points at Diagon Alley and says how wonderful it is, don't get me wrong, it is wonderful. But and then it's like, well, what is Disney doing in response? And it's like, well, Disney's been doing things. I mean, if you look at Cars Land, or if you look at Mystic Manor, or if you look at what they've just done with the Ratatouille ride and the land around that, there's some amazing, amazing work that the Imagineers are doing right now. And that coupled with what's coming with Avatar and with Star Wars Land, I mean, there's some absolutely stunning stuff coming. And even if you look at something like Knott's Berry Farm, I mean, think about it. Just in the last year or two, you took, you know, and again, this is Matt Wimmett, former president of Disneyland, has put a program in place to the effect of like, look, let's just make this better. Let's just make this a quality experience. So you've got Garner Holt creating these amazing next gen AA figures that, that were installed last year in the Timber Mountain Flume ride. And just recently the Calico Mine ride has gotten a redo, coupled with the really charming stuff they put into Camp Snoopy. This is all out there. Everybody is stepping up their game. And, you know, I know, you know, Mouse Chat, you know, everybody wants to be a Disney fan, but it's like, look, we all win in this situation, all right? Yeah. The fact that suddenly these guys are competitive and feel like, well, Universal did this, let's do that, or, you know, we need to be competitive here at Knott's, so let's step up what we're doing.
Yeah, it definitely benefits everybody.
This is a great time, you know, and, you know, I feel sorry for the Disney diehards, but
yeah.
What are you going to do? I mean, you just sort of, you have to admit that, you know, I think that's the other thing important to always understand is that while the Disney fans, some of them, may operate in a vacuum, that they only focus on what Disney is doing. The Walt Disney Company does not. And, you know, they're keenly, again, the story I told you about the three Imagineers trying to get in during the soft opening. They're keenly aware of the competition is up to, and they want to, you know, want to keep tabs and, if possible, surpass it.
Yeah, which is good for everybody.
Yep. I agree.
Absolutely.
I have a quick question, if you don't mind. It's kind of a little bit off topic, but I thought if anyone knows, it would be you. It's next to impossible to get a dinner reservation at Be Our Guest. Mm-hmm. Why haven't they put in a character breakfast there?
Oh, boy.
I mean, they've got the space. They have the interest. There's no question.
You know, it's interesting. I was actually asking Food and Beverage about this, a friend who works on that side. And, you know, the original answer was they are still trying to get their arms around a running, because you have to remember that for lunch, it's quick service. All right. So you've got your kitchen set up entirely to do quick service, you then shut down, and at night, you're full service, you're fine dining, or the equivalent. The concern was that, okay, so if we do breakfast, you know, we can't really be doing quick service, you know, that would, you know, because, you know, if you're going to ask people to pay the price point, that it makes sense. I mean, and that's the other thing. It's like, all right. So if we're doing character dining, you know, I guess they did a test where it's like, okay, we have Beast and we have Belle, but you can't, you know, face it, you can't have more than one Belle and one Beast, you know. So, you know, that they first would be in the West Wing, and then they do the main dining room, and then they'd go into the giant spinny wood thing room, whatever they call that room.
Is it the garden? Is it the garden room or
the rose room?
Something with the
rose room. Okay, but you understand. Okay, so you because again, all the little kids will be, oh, look, there they are, you know, waiting for them to show up. So you then had to, well, what else have we got? So do we bring in Gaston? You know, do we bring in Lumiere?
That would actually be awesome, because when you see people in the park, they love Gaston, and he has so much fun with that, being that character.
He does. He does.
That would be awesome, actually.
But remember, Gaston outside in the village, fun. Gaston when he's inside the castle, about to kill the Beast, not so much fun.
But not everyone has that intellectual. Because see, I didn't really make that leap until you said it, and then I was like, oh yeah.
Well. To see, that's
plus,
the thing.
Who wants 5 dozen eggs for breakfast? I mean,
there we go. There we go.
You know, just... But you can have
they
like
would,
the 5 dozen
point,
egg.
They would make
often.
A lot more money though, because it's a big area.
Yeah.
They would, but it just
and if they got rid of the quick service lunch and just did, you know, character breakfast and lunch, it'd be a huge moneymaker probably.
Well, as
and
of right
could
now,
they actually cut off those two rooms. They could do it with just the main room. Actually, it would work perfectly. They could even do a buffet. Like they do at Tusker.
But here's the thing. You have to be able, you know, and in fact, what's interesting, if you look at that facility, I mean, for example, the Rose Room, if you'll remember, for fine dining gets cut off. That's not available, because that's where you're actually doing a lot of your alcohol prep. And, you know, again, there's certain aspects of fine dining that you need that extra prep space. Don't get me wrong, that they know they're leaving money on the table. I think that the pushback from the buffet idea, you know, just the whole notion of, you know, can we then turn this? Because, again, you know, they start serving lunch in there at like 10:30, don't they? You know, 10:30, 11.
I think it's 11. Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, it just was the notion of, okay, so, oh, you know, in theory, we start serving breakfast in here at 7. You know, we shut it down at 10, we clean up, we get it ready to turn at 11. You know, you it's just, I think it's something they're it's problematic, you know, and in fact, they know how much money they're leaving on the table, and it kills them, you know, but it just, it's from a, you know, from a character point of view, it's like, what, you throw Lumiere in there, you throw Mrs. Potts and Chip. You know, I mean, it just, how do you, you know,
oh, I love again, Chip.
But you're going to be asking people, I mean, how much is character dining on property now? You know, 45 per person, 50?
Well, for breakfast, it's around, what, 25?
Yeah,
breakfast
about 30.
Isn't as bad. Okay. Yeah, so.
But you understand.
So breakfast is kind of manageable.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's just sort of like you can't cut into your lunchtime. You can't cut into your, you know, your, because again, you know, that's, you've got people booking this out 6 months. Not saying that they
believe
won't.
Us.
Yeah.
And you can't
not saying
get
that they
dinner.
Won't circle around.
You can't
to the,
get well, it.
Well, you know, the other thing, frankly, they learned the hard way that. I mean, what was it? Initially, they thought they'd be able to get people in for dinner and have them out in 60 to 75 minutes. And they found out, you know, the hard way that people were actually lingering in there as long as 90, sometimes 105 minutes because of not only the alcohol component, but, you know, mom and dad, after a long day in the park, you know, there were a lot of them. Yeah, go ahead, kids. Go out and play. Mommy and daddy will be in here drinking.
Well, there's wine in here.
Yeah.
Do you know what's funny, though? It's not the most relaxing place to eat.
No,
like,
it
to
isn't.
Me, it's not a place I would sit. I would be more inclined to sit at a lot of places than that. Even the Plaza, I think, is more conducive to sitting and talking after dinner than that place.
But if you know what? First chance
that's
you've had to sit down
true.
All day.
If there's,
there we go.
There's the
there
only
we go.
Place you can get alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
True.
That is a valid point. I actually never thought about it that way.
That's right. So you're sitting there nursing your $12 beer, and it's just sort of like,
which is worth every penny at the end of the day.
I understand, but at the same time, you are not getting up. You were like, I am here. I got my beer, and
I made
the poor slob.
180 days ago.
That's right. And so to hell with the people who are out there standing in line, and you know they, it took them. It took them 6 months to sort of realize that they were going to have to cut a lot of reservations out to accommodate the people who were going to linger. And that's
is
where
that
they are.
Is that why it's impossible to get it? It's not that, because we thought, we were kind of like, hey, this has been open for 2 years. Why is it still impossible to get a reservation? But it makes sense if they've actually cut back the number that are available.
They had to. I mean, it's just that they were dealing with people who were being seated at 10:30 at night when the park was closing at 11. It was a bad, you know, they don't like talking about it now. But that first year, you know, where they learned the hard way, that coupled with the fact that, you know, think about the poor slobs who get seated in the West Wing where, you know, eventually the waiters in there began using flashlights because people are looking at the menu.
It's
and
so
like,
dark. Yeah.
Yeah. And that coupled with the fact that, God forbid, you're the person seated in the table next to where the portrait changes, because you know your view the entire evening is other people's asses because they're coming in to take pictures of, you know, it's like, honey, our romantic meal, you know, look at the butt on that guy, you know, like.
I think I've mentioned this on Mouse Chat before. That room
have
is a tourist
really?
Mecca.
Yeah
but
I mean,
you didn't mention the butt part.
Oh no, I didn't.
Well, no, again, it's
no,
only
that stays
those
with Jim.
Specific tables, all right, that, you know, everybody else is sort of walking through going, wow, but the poor people seated right there, you know, just sort of like, are you enjoying your meal? Well, sort of, you know, just,
that's
I don't know.
That's going to become the most coveted seat in the house, thanks to you.
Well, you know.
I'd like the Jim Hill table, please.
No. Just, I'll have the rump roast. Thank you. Okay. Anyway. But no, I mean, this is what the part of Disney that I find fascinating. I mean, the Imagineers will design this amazing space. And then you hand it off to ops and they have to figure out how to make it work. And even the Imagineers, I mean, I love the story about how they're building, the you know, Be Our Guest. And it comes time now to install the beautiful, you know, chandelier that has been, you know, painstakingly recreating the, you know, the one from the movie. And they go to bring it in the door and it doesn't fit because nobody's bothered to measure it. And it's sort of like, you got to dismantle it before you can bring it in. But, you know, they designed this amazing space. And then it's up to the people in food and beverage to figure out how to operate it from day to day. And it's been you know, don't get me wrong, they make a lot of money off of that place, but it's been torturous, you know, and that coupled with, you know, it's just, for me lately, it's just been interesting to go there, you know, in the afternoon and to watch this line of people standing there under umbrellas because there's no shade structure. You know, they just handing out the umbrellas to, you know, because, you know, you just don't want somebody to have heat stroke.
Yeah. Well, they have the water cart too, don't they?
They do. They do. Yeah. And, you know, it's one of these things where nobody thought about that. Nobody, you know,
but you couldn't really effectively put any shade on that bridge because it would totally ruin how it looks. It's not like you can put an awning.
I totally agree. But at the same time, this is Central Florida and they will have been there for, you know, 50 years come 2021. And it's not like it suddenly got warm in here, you know?
Yeah. You're going to have to suffer for that cream puff.
Yeah. Or they could have built the structure. Yeah. They could have maybe made the structure a little bigger inside where they could have fit more of the people. So they're not waiting outside, but.
Well, the other thing, frankly, have you ever done the quick service?
Yeah.
The kiosk.
The kiosk is like, it's horrible. Because you get in the line behind somebody who doesn't know how to speak. They don't speak English. They don't know what to press. They're trying to add mayonnaise and they don't. It's just like, ugh. And you're like waiting behind them. And it's just it just takes forever.
And that's always the line.
You're like, oh, they just stuck me in this one. And I got eight people that are trying to figure out how to do this on one kiosk and they have no clue what they're doing.
But they convinced
though? That food is really good though. It's really like the best quick service lunch you can get on property.
No argument. But again, when your dining experience starts off with just, again, you're standing in the sun, you finally make it indoors and you're just standing there behind that person who's like, do you want a sandwich? I don't want a sandwich. Do you want soup? Do you want that? And it's just sort of like, I want to strangle you. You know, it's just sort of like, that's not a happy theme park experience. But they did, you know, they did that on the back of, well, you know, over at Captain Jack's at the Polynesian. This seems to work so well, you know. Not understanding that, like, when you have a tiny little coffee shop set up, you know, and, you know, a finite number of people at any one time that are dealing with this, you know, compared to this cavernous restaurant where you're trying to get, you know, dozens of people, you know, orders in, you know, 5 minutes time. It wasn't an equivalent. It wasn't an idea that was going to work in this situation. But they're married to it. You know, they can't change at this point.
We're going to break this show up into two parts. So this is part one of Jim Hill. And then next week, come back to mousechat.net and we'll have part two of Jim Hill. So join us here next week on Mouse Chat. Please go over to iTunes. Also, you can leave feedback for us over at iTunes and leave a rating for us over at iTunes as well. You can contact us at comments@mousechat.net. You can also follow us on Facebook if you just search on Mouse Chat. And this show is sponsored by Pixie Vacations. You can go over to pixievacations.com and they will plan a Disney World, Disneyland, or Disney Cruise Line vacation for you over at pixievacations.com. So come back here next week to listen to part two of Jim Hill on mousechat.net.